Welcome. Please accept Jim and John's final invitation to join them as they once again ask each other, what do you think about... John, what do you think about this being our final episode of the podcast?
Jimmy, I have really mixed feelings about this. I truly do. When you suggested this idea back, 3 years ago, I thought it was a great idea and that we could be able to go forever because we have tons of topics amongst us that we talk about all the time. But having a chat with you for 5 minutes or 10 minutes on a subject is a little bit different than trying to come up with a full half hour podcast episode.
Amen.
And it has turned into a lot more work than I ever expected.
Yeah. And they're hard to do drunk too, the podcast. When we're talking, we're usually tipsy. So.
Yeah, that's an absolute fact, but it's been a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Cool.
Do you have thoughts?
About the same boat as you. Yeah. It's definitely different doing it in a podcast rather than doing it at Lake Hope or
just
someone's
chatting.
House or yeah.
So. It's a different thing and it's a lot more work.
Yeah, the damn editing is a bitch.
Right. And making sure that you've really documented what you thought about and things. I mean, you know, if we just wanted to be like just talk and not really care about what was said, I think we could fill hours of stuff. But if you're going to stay on topic and actually give the topic justice, it's a lot of work.
Yes, it is. And now, after this 3-year run, I'm going to do something for you.
Okay, please do.
In doing so, I will titillate you as I never have to date.
Well, as far as the podcast knows.
The topic also serves to stimulate me in conjunction with giving you pleasure.
All right.
Also, out of respect for the vast store of miscellanea we have amassed and dispensed, I don't want to bum fiddle our final episode. And now, young cockapert, allow me to invaginate your mind after you respond to this, our final query.
I've never been invaginated before.
John, what do you think about the following statement made by Don Worley in his article entitled Examining the Mystery of the Para-Apes? Which was found in the volume 41, number 4 installment of the Flying Saucer Review. Here it goes. We shall take a limited look at where these hulking ape-man-like entities are seen, their physical and emotional nature, the UFO link, and the dimensional telepathic factor. Let me make it clear at the outset. I do not intend to ridicule or put down the legions of Sasquatch/Bigfoot investigators. All their efforts, their data, and their cellars full of plaster foot castings. Maybe there are two distinct types. A settled-in, seemingly physical ape, and the bio-etheric-like red-eyed ape. However, I frankly doubt this. And I believe that they are all the controlled creatures of the intelligence behind UFOs. As we look at the elements of this murky enigma, you may begin to understand why I have this conviction.
This just tickles me to death, Jimmy. This topic right here, the whole notion of tying together Bigfoot and UFOs is fabulous. Lead on, brother.
Well, strap on as I continue to warm your cockles.
Yes, sir. Warm away.
Worley goes on to state that what he defines as para-apes are simply what the rest of the world calls Zutha, Gulivavan, Almasti, Mapinguari, Yowie, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Mighty Mo, Old Slewfoot, etc.
Yeah, those are all Bigfoots.
As a matter of fact, he actually states, to simplify it all, I will call them para-apes. There's nothing like adding vague new nomenclature to an already mile-long list in an effort to clarify things.
Yeah, the vaguer the better, because then you cover everything, right? You can't be wrong when you're vague.
It's Worley's contention, however, that the ape-like creatures coming out of or seen in the vicinity of UAPs are not flesh and blood creatures. He writes that he bases this claim on the fact that despite hundreds of thousands of incidents since the 1800s, not one hairy being has ever been delivered to a laboratory for scientific surgical confirmation. This is one valid indication that we are not here dealing with a flesh and blood thing. You know, maybe his name should have been Wooly, because that all sounds like a lot of woo to me.
Well, he's just trying to justify why it is that everybody says they see these things, yet there is no corpse. I mean, we've documented, you know, at least four or five episodes on this thing that they called them wild men. They called them this, they called them that. And people saw things.
Some of them at least had to be, they saw something.
Yeah, they saw something. I agree.
I will concede that Wooly does go on to mention anecdotes that do, if factual, bear out his claim.
Yeah, see, he's just, I mean, yeah, I mean, he's trying to explain it.
Now, in the town of Rochdale, Indiana, several individuals experienced run-ins with a large red-eyed manimal.
Yes, manimal. Remember that TV show?
I didn't watch it, but I do recall it, yeah. These sightings began with a UFO incident in the form of a luminous light. What other kind is there, right?
That's exactly right. They are all luminous.
The craft descended from the skies and reportedly silently exploded above a cornfield beside the home of one Lou Rogers. Thereafter, an ape-like being was seen in the vicinity, a being that did not seem to be entirely corporeal.
Excellent.
The creature could run through mud without leaving any tracks. At times, it appeared as a transparent form that witnesses could actually see through. The thing was impervious to gunshots, as illustrated by an occasion in which a posse of investigators fired a volley of shots into the spook with no effect.
Now, do we have a time for this?
It was in 72.
1972?
I should have put that at the beginning. It's coming up here in a couple of lines. But it was the summer of 72.
Okay.
This thing ripped apart 170 chickens, leaving the bloodless and uneaten carcasses on the ground. Why would it do such a grisly thing, you might ask?
I am. Why would it do such a grisly thing, Jim?
Well, that's easy. Who doesn't have that on their extraterrestrial wish list, you know?
I was one of his bucket list items.
Yeah. Here, let me check my own list. Pilot a UFO to an alien planet.
That's on my list, too.
Let me go down. Yep, right there it is.
Oh,
dismember 170 members of whatever species passes for local chicken.
Okay, well, that's down on my list, too, but it's below having sex with the green alien girl.
It's just above for me.
Oh, okay. Well, as long as we get them all off the list, we're going to be fine.
While Wooly's account of this UFO para-ape sighting is slim, the website, strangemag.com, presents a more in-depth telling of this story and provides the date of August 1972. This version confirms that the Bigfoot-type creature appeared after several nighttime UFO sightings. Mrs. Lou Rogers was the first person to have a run-in with the creature. Stepping outside one evening, Mrs. Rogers was startled by a growling from the dark. The growl was followed by an odd boo or ooh vocalizations. Though she could see nothing in the evening murk, Mrs. Rogers felt that something was watching her. So she abandoned whatever chore originally brought her outside and slipped back into the house.
In other words, she got freaked out and she went back in.
Oh, yeah. Smart woman.
Yeah, that would have freaked me out, too.
The creature returned nightly, pounding on the outside of the house and rapping at its windows.
You know, if it happens one night and then the next night, I'm getting somebody there on the third night. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah. Lou Rogers is quoted as saying, whatever it was, it must have gotten braver because the noise got louder and louder each night. It would always come around 10 to 11:30 each night. You could feel it coming. I didn't know how to explain it. And then the knocking would start. The Rogers family did manage to catch glimpses of the creature, describing it as large and broad-shouldered. The thing would stand upright like a man, but would drop to all fours when running, and it stank like a garbage heap.
Man.
The Rogers wondered if maybe it were an ape that had escaped from a zoo or a circus. Mr. Rogers added the following. The funny thing is that it never left footprints, even in the mud. And when it ran through tall weeds, you couldn't hear anything. And sometimes when you looked at it, it looked like you could see through it, like it was a ghost or something.
But yet it's corporeal enough to knock on windows and doors.
Yeah. Hmm. But then ghosts move things and knock and rap and all that shit too. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, maybe.
The website also provides a little more detail on the deaths of the chickens.
Oh, well, please elaborate, please.
The killings took place in two separate instances on the night of August 22nd, 1972 at Carter Burdine's farm.
So all in one night, it killed 170 chickens.
Hell yeah.
That's what you call going wild, baby.
Hog wild and pig crazy.
Yeah.
Cock wild and bullet crazy.
There you go.
During the first, Carter and his uncle, Bill Burdine, found the gruesome disembodied remains of over 60 chickens scattered along a path from the chicken coop to the front yard of the house. None of the fowl had been devoured, just riven and discarded.
Man.
The men called the local marshal out to the farm. After the lawman departed, the two men returned to the chicken coop where they saw that the creature had returned to the scene of the crime. Bill Burdine released the following statement. The thing completely blocked out the light in the chicken house. The door is 6 feet by 8. Its shoulders came to the top of the doorway. It looked like a gorilla with long brownish colored hair. I never saw its face, but it was making an awful groaning sound.
So this time it's not translucent.
It's blocking out light. Why do you think them chicken need a light in the coop?
I always thought that was to make them go to sleep and wake up when you
want. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Regulate the
daylight type stuff.
That's right.
So they lay, right?
Yeah, because they do one egg a day, but you can trick them into thinking.
Exactly.
Okay, so that's probably why. The men fired on the beast with a shotgun. The brute ran off, unaffected by the shots, and disappeared in the surrounding fields.
You know, if you're unaffected by the shot, why do you need to run off?
Maybe the noise scared it. I don't know.
You know what I'm saying? Am I getting shot at? What do I care? I'm still ripping chicken.
The two men counted a total of 110 disassembled and exsanguinated chicken corpses left behind by the ape-like thing.
Yeah, that's what you really, 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 yeah, you got your get your ripping on when you're doing that, don't you?
The website concludes the story with, after this incident, the reports of the strange beast subsided. Whatever the monster of Rochdale was, it vanished as mysteriously as it arrived.
It ran out of chickens.
Yeah, it killed its quota, so it was gone. Next planet. In Galveston, Indiana, a fisherman recreating in the twilight felt some kind of entity place a hand on his shoulder. He turned and saw a tall specter standing behind him. The fisherman leapt to his feet, and in doing so, he must have spooked the whatever it was, because it too jumped and then took off running. The guy pursued, cautiously maintaining a safe distance. The beastie was the faster of the two, though, pounding across the nearby bridge, its feet slapping the structure's blacktop surface. The tall entity ran into some high weeds, presumably on the far side of the bridge, and shortly thereafter, an orange glowing light rose up into the sky from said weeds. presumably taking the mysterious presence with it. Worley outlines another incident that played out as follows. Four glowing UFOs of the size of an oil tank hovered over a tree line. Luminous rays shot from the craft to the ground, transporting a group of para-apes with refulgent red eyes to the landscape below. A farmer named Ray Davis and his brother observed the arrival of the beasts. Evidently fearing an attack, they fortified their home by stringing barbed wire around the house and shared sentry duty on the roof.
This is crazy.
It is.
I mean, okay, so you see a UFO beaming down ape men, and your first thought is, I'm going to go string some barbed wire?
Yeah.
Fuck no. My first thought is, I'm getting in the car.
As the visits of the para-apes grew in menace, the men, armed with a rifle of unknown caliber and a 12-gauge shotgun, fired on the creatures from their rooftop perch.
This makes no sense to me.
It makes perfect sense to me. Here is Worley's account of the remainder of the incident. In 1 week, they used more than $120 worth of shells and had only bruised shoulders to show for it. One night, two para-apes moved nearer by the barn. Ray Davis, the farmer, tried to talk to them and gave them 5 minutes to come out in the open. The time passed in silence, and the men opened up at close range. Davis used a 12-gauge Mossberg with pumpkin ball shells and was sure he didn't miss. The fusillade sent the creatures in screaming retreat. In the morning, nothing but bullet holes were found. Newsmen and lawmen had been called out, but when they were there, nothing happened. So they went away disbelieving.
Well, okay.
During the summer, a number of outside investigators did experience the phenomena. In the end, the sheer terror of it all caused the couple involved to divorce and move away. And I don't understand that statement because it's talking about this guy and his brother, and surely they weren't married.
This is crazy.
I know, because how'd they get divorced?
Right. How'd they get married in the first place? No, but what I'm saying is they were doing this evidently nightly, because for a week they're shooting.
Oh, that's what worries you?
Dude, get people out, start charging admission. Come shoot the ape man. It's a shooting gallery. Good God.
And then there is a note recording the fact that in the New Jersey counties of Morrison, Warren, Hunniston, and Sussex, no fewer than 60 witnesses saw the ape-like entities along with ruby red UFOs and other triangular craft.
Yeah, again, this is crazy shit, man.
Also, in Sangus, California, on the Santa Clarita Ranch, para-apes were observed wearing glowing blue belts after a period of UFO activity.
This is so Star Trek. It's
coming back from a rave or something.
Yeah, exactly. They were at a concert. They had those broken tab things, you know, glow sticks.
Yep. Yeah. Another story that involves UFOs and Bigfoot-like beings comes to us from Ohio, occurring on the Mogador Reservoir east of Akron.
Okay.
Two men, Joe Butler and Elmer Grant, were out fishing when they noticed a large orange sphere in the sky. The sphere shot a beam of yellow down to the ground. Intrigued, Butler took out his flashlight and flashed it at the spheroid craft. But this got him more than he bargained for. The vessel moved to a point above the man and hit Butler with its own beam, paralyzing him.
Oh, man, don't shine a flashlight at a UFO is what I'm just learning.
However, his mobility returned within a minute, allowing him to dive inside the tent the men had erected earlier.
You ever been camping in a tent?
Yeah.
I've always felt like there is nothing between me and every other creature in the woods.
Yeah. I don't want to. Yeah. If anything, I've never been where anything dangerous might be around.
Sure. But you hear everything, don't you?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that hiding in a tent from a UFO shooting beams at me is not going to get the job done.
Through the tent flap, Butler watched while Grant was then hit by the beam and was then released too.
Yeah, through the tent flap. See this? See this? It's not going to work.
Well, I think the ones in the tent and the other one didn't have the sense to get into the protective
cover yet.
Cover, oh,
so,
right.
So he stood there for a minute and watched the other guy get paralyzed. What and then the he fuck? Goes diving in the tent and he's standing there going, what the hell are you diving in the tent for?
Yep. And look here, that is what happened. Following Butler's lead, Grant jumped into the tent with his friend where the two cowered while a orange glow flooded the area.
Man, this is bad.
Evidently content that its mission here was complete, the craft emitted a woo-woo and then departed.
No, it's that UFO woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo-woo sound that, you know, the movies make.
I bet it is. Just the two of them there threw me.
Yeah, you need to string them together.
Yeah. With the sphere's departure, the two men returned to their fishing, because why the fuck not?
this bullshit right here, right?
But their enjoyment was again interrupted when, quote, a big, bent-over, long-armed beast began to rush at them through the woods, end quote.
Yeah, rushing at me? I'm gone, daddy, gone.
Then, Butler pulled a pistol and fired 6 shots at the intruder. Evidently, the duo was firearm fishing.
Yeah, evidently so.
Then, true to form, they fled to the safety of their tent.
Man, I'm telling you, a tent is no place to be hiding.
After sitting within the tent, bathed in the orange glow of the UAP and listening to the para-ape beating sticks together, the men resolved to make a run for it. According to Worley, their frantic rush down the trail with Elmer hanging on to Joe's shirt tail ended in success. Again, according to Worley, when the men returned home, they saw that they were experiencing the following symptoms.
Ooh, they've got symptoms?
Their faces were red and swollen.
Oh, they've got radiation exposure.
They became nauseated, had runny bowels, syrupy yellow urine, dehydration, exhaustion, and depression.
Yep. Radiation poisoning.
Another symptom the two experienced was a shared dream experience. In these dreams, the men once again encountered the para-apes. The dream ape men displayed high levels of intelligence, questioning the men in great detail on what Worley called some aspects of para-ape / human relations.
Evidently, these relations involve shooting at para-apes.
Well, they started it. They shot the beam.
I don't know. Banging on sticks and stuff doesn't usually get you shot, but whatever.
Well, we'll never know because Worley did not elaborate on just what those relations were in his article.
I think we can make assumptions about what kind of relations those were. You know, relations.
Now, I have to say, I clicked around on the interwebs to try to find corroborating articles, entries, evidence of each of these, but I'm sad to say that I found no references other than the notation that exists in Worley's Flying Saucer Review article.
Oh, so there were no collaborating newspaper stories or anything?
All I was finding was references to his article, except in the case of the Rochdale, Indiana affair, and in the following story related by Worley.
So the Rochdale, Indiana was in the paper.
That one was, and another one from Ohio, not far from Columbus.
Okay, tell me about that one.
A series of events that allegedly took place in West Jefferson, Ohio, indicate a link between the para-ape entities and UFOs. This series of events all began when Pat Evans, whom Worley described as curious and clever, found a footprint near her slashed trash bags.
That's called a raccoon footprint.
As one does upon finding the trash rifled through and strewn across the yard, Pat decided to put out greasy bacon in an effort to lure the culprit back and discover its identity.
So possum, raccoon.
This resulted in the appearance of giant red-eyed apes in the vicinity.
Note to self, keep the bacon in the fridge.
Their visits became so regular that friends of Pat's living in Columbus and West Jefferson would stop by at night to observe from her darkened home.
No way.
But nobody thought to take pictures, evidently.
Evidently not. No. Take a picture of it.
Nah. Worley quotes Pat as describing the creatures thusly. Them suckers was tall. Tall enough they would burn the tops of my redbud trees. I hope that's not a euphemism. My whole front yard was burned up by these things. Once again, I hope that's not a euphemism. Anything they touched, it died. You couldn't believe it. They ruined my beautiful yard.
And she's fucking like keeping putting bacon out for these things to come back. This is her fault. She killed her yard.
One truly weird outcome of Pat's inviting these para apes or Bigfoots or whatever they were into her neighborhood was the fact that other stranger things began to put in appearances.
No kidding.
According to Worley, the red glowing something out of mythology, half horse, half man, was one.
What? A red glowing centaur.
It had a pointed head and ears, fiery slanted eyes, a beard, and skinny wings. The horrifying apparition moved across the yard on long, cloven feet, leaving hoof prints in the snow.
Good God. Does nobody ever think of a camera?
Evidently not. An odd UAP visited one morning, too. It appeared as a brilliant orange balloon that swooped down by the back door of the house. Pat claimed it seemed to pass by with a deliberate slowness, enticing her and her husband to approach. And approach they did, coming to within what they called touching distance. They saw that the gondola of the craft contained three humanoids.
What?
One of these was wearing a black suit, while the others were clad in heavy, furred black jackets. The one wearing the suit acknowledged the Evanses, wishing them, and a good morning to you, in an English accent.
That is the funniest thing.
After this, the balloon ascended until it was out of sight.
Uh-huh. That's how balloons work. That's absolutely how they work.
After a year and a half of this weirdness, the, quote, silent triangle again became alive with normal night creature sounds, and the para-apes never returned, end quote. But only after a giant UFO had settled down into the creek valley and disappeared by morning.
You know, this is the kind of UFO sighting and testimony that I think really ruins the entire endeavor.
John, bite your tongue.
I am sorry, but this is completely non-credible.
Incredible. You mean incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Incredible. It's beyond all. No. I love that these aliens travel in a gondola underneath a balloon, right?
Only once they reach M-class planets.
And they have English accents. That is fabulous. Oh my God, I want what she's been smoking.
As I mentioned earlier, I was overjoyed to find a newspaper article covering Pat Evans's story. The encounter received full page coverage in the September 14th, 1985 edition of Dayton, Ohio's Journal Herald. It's right there on page 21. However, the woman's actual name, as revealed in the article, was Betty Powell. Odd how she allowed her name to be used in 1985, but Worley attempted to grant her anonymity in his 1996 article. I mean, the cat was already well out of the bag by then.
Yeah, well, he didn't do his homework to figure out, you know. Or maybe she didn't like the attention she got because, you know, this is a little bit hard to believe.
Yeah, because her yard was scorched.
Ruined.
Before we continue, let's pause a minute for a word about Anchor Podcasting. And we're back. All right. Let me tell you this. Don Worley is not the first to make a connection between UFOs and ape-like manimals.
I agree. Yeah, he is not.
The website Gaia.com claims this story is found in a diary, supposedly authentic, kept by a guy living among the Native Americans in the Rocky Mountains, and it's told in Brad Steiger's Mysteries of Time and Space. Within the journal is an 1888 account that relates an encounter between UFOs and Bigfoot and some cattle ranchers and a group of Native Americans in Northern California. In the entry, the Native Americans call the para-ape creatures crazy bears and explain that they were left here by a small moon that descended from the sky. Once the crazy bears disembarked, the moon flew back up into the sky. And that's about that.
That's all I got to say about that.
Yeah, I would like to have read more. In another instance, in Cincinnati, Ohio, in 1973, a woman named Reefa Heitfield and her daughter were awakened in the middle of the night to a beam of light extending down from a bulbous umbrella shape in the sky. Tracking the light to where it landed in the nearby woods, the two noticed a grayish simian creature wandering toward the beam. Before they knew it, both the ape and the craft disappeared. And then, in Chapter 6 of their 1978 book, Creatures of the Outer Edge, Jerome Clark and Lauren Coleman stated the following. In some cases, these creatures, especially the manimals, have appeared to be UFO occupants. In other instances, UFOs have been sighted in areas where people were encountering creatures. They go on to assert, "We think this much is clear. UFOs and creatures are generated by a single paranormal mechanism." Some of the linked UFO manimal sightings related in this book include, in September 1975, near Waterloo, Indiana, the following took place. A farmer had to take a leak at 3 o'clock in the morning. In making his way to the bathroom, he noticed a red light coming through one of the windows, so he stopped to check it out. The light appeared to be about the size of a car's headlight and was situated in a soybean field 75 yards from the house.
Okay.
On the perimeter of the illuminated area, the farmer noticed a large bipedal thing walking toward the light, swaying as it did so. Then the light changed from red to a blinding white, burned thusly for 5 seconds or so, then disappeared, as did the bipedal creature. The next morning, the farmer went out to the field and found a circular patch of brown soybeans. The circle of death had a 30-foot diameter. The soybeans outside of the circle were their regular healthy green. A second story that took place in Uniontown, Pennsylvania in October 1973 goes something like this. Somewhere around 16 people witnessed a red ball of light floating above a field outside of town. A 22-year-old guy did what any red-blooded American would do. He grabbed his .30-06 rifle and two 10-year-old boys and drove out to where the orb was hovering.
Yeah. Come on, boys. Let's go shoot us a UFO.
They stopped and disembarked from their vehicle, walking up a hill to get a better look. They saw that the light had now changed from red to white in color.
So it's backing up.
It had descended and was now suspended just over the ground. It was 100 feet in diameter and emitted a noise that sounded like a lawnmower. The trio could also hear screaming that seemed to come from somewhere nearby.
That was me.
Suddenly, in the illumination provided by the UFO, they could see two large ape-like things with green glowing eyes.
Weren't they red before?
Different incident. As related in Creatures of the Outer Edge, quote, both had long, dark gray hair and arms that almost reached the ground. The taller one, about 8 feet in height, was running its left hand along the fence. The shorter, which stood slightly over 7 feet tall, seemed to be hurrying along to keep up with its companion. Both were making a whining sound, like a baby crying, and apparently were communicating with each other via this strange noise. So the three witnesses fled for home and called the police.
Yes, this is the proper behavior.
The police arrived on site at 9:45 p.m., approximately 45 minutes after the initial sighting of the UFO. They investigated, but saw nothing. However, they did hear thrashing and crashing noises from the nearby woods.
Okay, that's something to be investigated, fellas. Let me clue you in here. This is part of the investigation.
The 22-year-old then began to act oddly. He shouted out that there was a brown object approaching, so he shot at it. Then he claimed something was coming at them from out of the woods. Cops shone his headlights in the area, indicated, but saw nothing. Long story short, the cop called Stan Gordon, famed Pennsylvania ufologist. Gordon and four other investigators came out to the scene that same night, arriving at 1:30 a.m. The 22-year-old began to act like he was possessed at some point after this. The book states the following. He then began breathing very heavily and started growling like an animal. He flailed his arms around and threw his father and George Lutz, one of the investigators, to the ground. He was running all around, swinging his arms and loudly growling like an animal. Suddenly, he collapsed on his face into a heavily manured area.
Oh, yuck.
Shortly afterwards, he started to come out of it and said, "Get away from me. It's here. Get back." Later, the man claimed to see a man in a black cloak wearing a hat and carrying a sickle.
So did this guy like get tested for LSD or for shrooms or some other psychoactive?
They didn't mention it. But after all of this hullabaloo, no UFO or para-apes were captured or photographed. Stan did go on to write many books, one of which was entitled Silent Invasion, the Pennsylvania UFO Bigfoot Casebook. In this work, Gordon writes, "As reports of creature sightings and UFO encounters came to our attention, my research associates and I noticed some interesting details. It appeared that in some instances, UFO sighting activity reported in some locations seemed to coincide with the appearance of the hairy giants. As we continued to monitor the ongoing activity, we noticed that in some cases, a UFO sighting would be reported in a certain area. Then, within hours to days later, a creature sighting would also be reported in that same area. We also saw that in some cases, a UFO would be observed minutes before or minutes after a creature encounter in the same vicinity." I gave the book a read prior to this episode. Mm-hmm. It was fun.
Oh, good. Was it well written?
It was okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Sometimes they're not laid out all that well and the argument isn't strong. It makes it hard to read.
Well, he's a professional.
Okay.
And that's about it. So, John, I know that you occasionally experience spontaneous ejaculations reminiscent of vaginitis at the mere mention of UAPs, but when so enthralled, have you ever in your wildest dreams considered the possibility that Bigfoots are piloting at least some of these vessels?
Absolutely not, Jimmy.
Think about it, John. Sasquatches could be traveling anywhere between here and Uranus, handling dongles and hanging out on poop decks.
Jimmy, I have to say that that was not something that I have encountered in my previous readings. Other than this whole notion that they're sort of coincident, right? I haven't really heard that the Bigfoots were pilots of the vessels.
And listeners or listener, that's it. That's the last episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope you're edified. And thanks for listening.
Yes. Thank you very much.
What do you think about was co-written by John Gordos and Jim Nuremann. Our theme music, In Suspense, was provided by PodSummit.com. Thanks to all you listeners. We really appreciate all of you having joined us in this endeavor. And that's about all I have to say about the whole thing. John, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I just want to thank you personally for thinking to add me to this endeavor. And I enjoyed it. It was fun, Jimmy.
Well, next time we have another pandemic, maybe we'll start another one.
And that's exactly right. We'll do some other topic, though, because I think I'm petered out on this.
Copyright 2022 by John Gordos and Jim Dumermuth. The men fired on the beast with a they already fucking did.
Next
that.
One down. Yeah.
In Galveston, Indiana, a fisherman. The Dream Ape Men displayed. God damn, man. What language am I speaking? I'm speaking para ape. In an effort to lure the culprit back and discover its entity.
Identity.
What did I say?
Entity.
Oh, maybe it was an entity. Looking up, they saw it was John's testicles.
Yes, indeed. Bulbous.